key of these, in some linear combination, these are just summed over I1 and through IT, so it's some pretty complicated thing. Then that's a p-form. So you take a p-form and wedge it with a q-form, now you have a p plus a q-form. And the question is, what happens if you act with the exterior derivative on that?
P plus q plus 1 form.
It's p plus q plus 1, yeah. It's really an element of lambda p plus q plus 1.
And it's going to have to be 1, and so it's going to be the derivative of 1 what's the second plus the derivative of the second what's the first?
Almost. You get some sign.
Oh.
So the question is, what's the sign?
Oh, it's going to be a plus sign for omega first and a minus sign for eta first. So you have to interchange them.
Depending on how big you are, actually, you know, I think.
Does it?
It's going to be something like this. That's what,
yeah.
So the question is, what is the sign?
Oh, it depends on how many places are you have to move that D.
That's right. So
does it only depend on omega? Or do you have to move eta past omega?
That's type of proof. You're right on target. Because it only has to move past omega, that's true. So it depends on P. It's not hard to figure out, but you should. Right, so it's anti-Leibniz, right? Well, let's just work it out. Let's give Juan an example here. Other one.
You've done this before, haven't we?
We did that.
What did we do? No, omega wedge eta.
Right, is equal to omega wedge to the peak.
Oh, right. There we go, that's
right.
The one.
Yeah, okay. This is the one we've done. Q times eta.
Right.
Okay. But here, okay, this is going to be the partial J of omega I1 through IP dx J wedge dx I1 through dx IP wedge, and then we've got the eta. Let's call it, let me do something besides, let's make it a K here. Then eta J1 through JP, sorry, this is a Q form. DX J1 through DX JQ plus. Now, notice the coefficient here is just the product of two functions. So this derivative is Leibniz on those two. So we have plus, I should have done this differently. Hang on. It's going to be the derivative of the coefficient, the full coefficient is I1 through IP eta J1 through JQ. Then we get a DXK wedge the DX I1 through DX IP wedge DX J1 through dxj2. Okay, now this is Leibniz because it's just a derivative of a function.
Right.
So you get d omega I1 through IP eta j1 through jp plus omega I1 through IP dk of eta J1 through JP, all of that times DXK wedge DX I1 all the way up to the last one, DXJQ.
Shouldn't be DK in the first term, DK omega I1.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, everybody with me here?
Yeah. What did you do?
Just the Leibniz rule on that function. It's a product of this function times that function. For each set of indices, right? For each choice of indices. So it's a sum of a whole bunch of things like this. Okay, now bring these back in here. So on the first one, I can write this. I just bring the first p plus 1 dx's right onto here, and I recognize the result as d omega. And then the last t indices sit on the eta. So this contracted with all those, they're in the right order. You don't have to interchange anything. So you just get this. On this last one, though, what I have is the I1 through IP are sitting in here, and that dxk is in the wrong place. So I have a dxk wedge, and now I've got the I1 through IP, which I can use to write that as an omega. And then I have that wedge, I've got a dk eta J1 through JP. And then we've got the last dx J1 through dx JP. Everybody see that? So now I have to move this dx. I need to get this over to here. But I've got a P form sitting in between. So I have to move this dxk through P factors of dx here. So those two give a minus 1 to the P times omega wedge dxk, just the product of these two. And now the dxk is the first one in that list, and I can write all of that with the dxk as d of eta. So what I get is d omega wedge eta plus minus 1 to the P omega wedge d of eta.
Okay.
Any questions? Okay. That sounds like no questions. Any questions on anything else? Are you coming with problems? Why did I say problems were due?
Friday. You're looking today, but you might change it to Friday.
This Friday. Yeah, okay, good. Yeah, sorry I didn't get the that last lecture posted yet. I'll get that up this evening. So, yeah, I hope you took notes on that. My dictionary of how to translate this thing. What we have shown, Juan, just to recap for everybody, is that using these three operators, I already said D and wedge and star, you can reproduce all of your vector calculus in three dimensions, but you can also do the same things or corresponding things in any number of dimensions. It generalizes the notation of vector calculus, cross products, and curl and divergence. You can do all of those with these. And we've derived a general formula for the divergence, and we've replaced the idea of a curl with an asymmetrized derivative, we've written the Laplacian using this notation in any number of dimensions, and so on. We've completed that, or we'll have completed it when these guys hand in all their homework on Friday. Any questions on the homework?
Up to you. Well, when do I have your class?
We can.
There's a little bit here and there.
Okay, nothing that would be enlightening to the whole group.
Probably won't.
Probably would, but but that's fine. That's fine. Yes.
For how long have they muted this notation?
How old is the notation, or how long have we been doing it in class?
How old
here?
Is
This was developed, I think, largely by Craton maybe a century ago. I'm not sure when he first introduced it. But it's not so distant from Boltzmann's introduction of the vector notation that is more common in, Boltzmann's notation with the vector signs and grad operator and curl. have certainly been used for 100 years, and you know, they were not developed all that far from one another, but since, you know, the vector notation works fine in three dimensions, and it happens because the star operator tells you how to take a two-form back to a vector, so you can pretty much write everything as either a function or a vector in three dimensions. In higher dimensions, you can't. And once people started thinking about four-dimensional geometry and Riemannian geometries and arbitrary dimensions, this notation came in very handy. So it's been around a while. Yeah, Joe? You had a question?
I don't think I did.
Catching flies. Okay, so I saw something. All right, and why?
It's kind of dumb, but... it is on the tree grid.
Yeah.
One over square root of g.
Oh, right. Well, it should be a square root of g there.
No. Sorry. That seems wrong, doesn't it?
That's true if g is 1. Where does that come from?
Let me just take this one up here. Hang on. I was trying to go through that formula you gave in class last time.
Okay.
Yeah, and then there's an issue with signs here, okay? Or, you know, for this, okay. And it's old stuff, but okay. We have an absolute value of g, but then we have 1 over g in here, right?
Yeah, but that's okay. Okay, all right. We have the square root of absolute value of g times 1 over g, which I can write as the square root of 1 over absolute value of g times 1 over... let's see, I can write, let's see.
Square root of g squared.
One over the square root of g.
I want to write it as the square root of absolute value of g squared. That's not quite right, is it?
You'd have to have the value of g then.
Yeah, there is a problem with signs.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, see, this is...
Could you make...
Yeah, we've got plus or minus square root of this thing squared.
Yeah.
So if g is negative, let's see, so what, where was I getting this? Oh, I have to run through some of this again.
Asymmetric symbol. Using.
Okay, so what we have is, the Levy-Civita tensor is root absolute value g. Epsilon I1 through IN. This is the anti-symmetric symbol, all plus or minus 1s or 0s. So, anti-symmetric under interchange of any two. Now, the... E up I1 through IN is G I1 J1 through G IN JN acting on E down. Like that. So far, so good. Now, we can take this square root out. We should get a sign here, right? I mean, if the determinant is negative, this doesn't have the opposite sign. So that sign, we want it to be there. That's the thing. Okay, so this is G I 1 J 1 through G I N J N. Now with the epsilon symbol. And this thing is a determinant times another epsilon symbol. So this is going to be epsilon I 1 through I N, where this thing has the same signs as that. These two are the same array.
That's what I'm saying.
It's just the anti-symmetric symbol with no sign. So, you know, this is the same thing as I1 through IN. Okay, let's do it that way. So, you know, this is... So, epsilon 1, 2, up to N is plus 1. Just by definition,
right.
And it's totally anti-symmetric. So just define them both the same way. and the anti-symmetry tells you all the other components. So what this ends up being is it's anti-symmetric on I1 through IN. So it has to be proportional to epsilon I1 through IN because it's anti-symmetric. But the proportionality constant we showed is the determinant of ZJ, determinant of that matrix, which is 1 over G. All right. And what that means is that, okay, this is equal to plus or minus 1 over the square root of the absolute value of G. So where I can write this as plus or minus 1 over absolute value of G. So this is explicitly the signature of the metric. I mean, this is the, what do I mean? The sign of the determinant. Okay, the sign that goes out front here is the sign of the determinant. Then we have epsilon I1 through IN. And that's EI1 through IN. So this is the anti-symmetric symbol, you know, with the plus sign here. We get an additional sign if the determinant of the metric is minus 1.
So it would be the minus 1 raised to the power of the signature, right? Or raised to signature.
No, it's just the it's a sign of the determinant of the metric.
Right. Wouldn't those be the same?
Say it again, the way you said it.
The negative 1 raised to the third wall. Maybe it's... Well, negative 1 raised to the signature. Yeah, right. Negative
now, the
raised
signature, see, signature, Lorentz signature is plus 2.
Is it?
Your sign will go away.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the trace of the unit metric.
Oh. Okay, very much. I was thinking it was plus 2.
Yeah. So, for space-time, the metric is that. So the determinant is minus 1. So you have a minus sign here. And you can see you need that because one of these is eta 0, 0, and it's minus 1, so you get a minus sign. So, good call. You need that sign. So, the 1 over G is right, but there is a sign that comes out explicitly with L. That's a positive factor.
Okay.
Now, the thing over here is only true if you're talking about an inclusion metric, right? Epsilon with the raised indices. And
which?
That one right there.
This?
Yeah.
No, we can define this. We can just define it to be that. It's just a symbol. It's not a tensor. It's not, you know, it doesn't have to have any special properties. So we can just, we can take that to be the case always, if we want.
Oh, okay, by definition.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or we, in a pseudospace, we could define it to have an appropriate sign, and then we don't put this sign because the sign's in here. We can do it either way.
Okay.
So it depends on whether or not, it depends on how you define this symbol, whether you get the sign here or whether the sign's built into that. So when you're writing notes on this, make a definition. You know, you could define it this way. If you're working in space-time, you might want to define this way or not. You can put it in explicitly here, or you can build it into that symbol.
I thought the definition was that everything raised, you know, with epsilon raised is with what you call it, with the metric. So.
You know, if you want this symbol to raise and lower with the metric, then you should put build a sign into it. So you could put, you know, a sign, sign of, you could put sign of G here, and then you don't get that.
Oh, okay.
Right. If you build that into the definition of the symbol, then it'll be there.
Okay, so it's not a tensor, it's a symbol at this point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So it's just a symbol.
Okay.
So you just have to be careful with your definition. So then here, you've got, you'll have an extra factor of sign G, and then this product will be absolute value. very important to be clear with your definitions, right? Just these problems can be long, but can be solved by carefully stepping through, remembering how you've defined everything, making sure, you know, often going back to define things. You discover as you work through a long problem that in the beginning you weren't careful, and you need to go back and carefully lay out what it is you're doing. I mean, this is what research is like. You know, you think you have an idea how to do something, and you realize you haven't defined your problem clearly enough. You know, stating the problem is 75% of your research. From there, it's just math. Follow through.
What is the range of I? And what is the range then in the dimension of the space?
Each of the I's runs from 1 to N. N is the dimension of the space.
Okay, so I is also the dimension of the space.
Each of the I's ranges through 1 through N.
Okay.
Where N is the dimension of the space. So I7 runs from 1 to 26. If the space is 26 dimensional.
Oh.
Right, so, you know, any one of these N indices runs, sum on J1 from J1 equals 1 to J1 equals 26.
Okay.
If we're doing bosonic string theory in 26 dimensions.
Another
question.
You said this is right. This is crazy over here, is true, right?
Yeah, that's now our
right
definition.
So, yeah. So why isn't this right?
Because that's not how this symbol is defined. This symbol is defined this way.
Okay.
Definition.
Okay.
Independently of how we define that symbol, which is defined that way. This is not a bunch of metrics on that.
Okay.
No. This is just a symbol.
So is one a symbol, the other one a tensor?
Yeah.
Okay.
E is a tensor.
Right. Okay.
Right. And it's often the case that, you know, things that are just like the Christoffel symbols, we raise and lower indices on that normally. But one way you might think of this, you could think of this as being, you know, the orthonormal, the orthonormal version of the Levi-Civita tensor. All right, so this in, you know, flat space and Cartesian coordinates is this. So you can raise and lower this with the Minkowski metric and get the right thing.
Right.
But this, in neither the up nor down form, does this ever take any value that's not plus or minus 1 or 0.
Okay.
Right. And if you raise these indices with a bunch of functions here, you know, you've got a bunch of functions multiplying it. You've got this dead G.
Okay.
So in an arbitrary coordinate system, you cannot regard this as a bunch of G's on that. All right. The reason I break E down into that is because this is what's involved in taking the determinant.
Right.
And so it allows me to write this mass, whatever it is, as the determinant of G. But I cannot write that as E with indices up. That's incorrect.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, but I guess it's a problem if we have to take the determinant of something with indices down, doesn't it? Or can we not do that?
Well, you can use this symbol. That's fine.
Right, but wouldn't that be right up to a sign? Because that means that the sign...
Yeah, you'd have to worry about the sign. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Determinants aren't carrying some extra sign around. So, you know, you'd want to drop this thing.
Do you want to drop that thing?
If I want the determinant of some M1, I1, you know, MN, IN, epsilon, I1 through IN, I1. No, that's not what I want. Sorry.
Turn backwards.
I want. I do not want this sign in that symbol.
Okay.
So if I've made this definition, then I want to divide out sign G. So fine. So if I've defined this with a sign G, I want to get rid of it before I take the determinant.
So this define G isn't an odd or anything. We're just sticking in there for the definition of a divergence formula. Is that correct?
Okay. The sign is in this thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
This in a Lorentzian space, this has the opposite sign of that.
Right.
Okay. Definite. Right. No matter how I define epsilon.
Right.
This and that have opposite signs in Minkowski space or in a space time.
Right.
A Lorentzian.
Right.
Debt metric equals minus one, minus something.
Right.
Okay.
Good.
Right. So, good?
Okay, I think so.
Alright. Other questions? Alright. Okay.
I'm going to come down for a second.
Alright. So, group. Shall we do Lie group?
Lie.
Oh, yeah. Time to review what we mean by a manifold. We discussed this last term in general relativity, but let's recall a manifold has charts. So it's a topological space. Covering by open set, there exist mappings from each open set of a covering by open set to open regions in Rn. So this is Rn. So here's some open region. And so for each open set and some cover, we have invertible mapping with some open region of Rn. These are called charts. They're just coordinate systems. So it makes small regions of our manifold look like the real numbers, and so So we can do calculus back over here because we know how to do it here and we know how to map back and forth. The way this ties into Lie group is each group element alright, there's a chart, right? There's some mapping to the to Rn. So map 1-to-1 with some point in Rn. You know, what that means is we can label group elements group element. Okay, so let's think of an example. The simplest example is rotations of the plane. General rotation matrix giving us x prime, y prime can be written as cosine theta minus sine theta, cos theta, acting on x, y, right? Because this gives us x cos theta minus y sine theta, and x sine theta plus y cos theta, and those are the new x and y coordinates, or position vector dependence, whether you're talking active or passive transformation. But this is an example of a group. Okay, this is g of theta. Okay, if we look at g of theta 1 times g of theta 2, right, this is a group product. It's a matrix product. So let's check cos theta 1 minus sine theta 1 prime theta 1 cos theta 1 times cos theta 2 minus sine theta 2 sine theta 2 cos theta 2, and what we get is cos theta 1 cos theta 2 minus sine theta 1 sine theta 2. This dives into that. Now this down here gives sine theta 1 cos theta 2 plus cos theta 1 sine theta 2. Then this into the top row gives cos theta 1 wait a minute, where are we here? Minus cos theta 1 sine theta 2 minus sine theta 1 cos theta 2. And then finally we get minus sine theta 1 sine theta 2 plus cos theta 1 cos theta 2. And now we have to dig way back in our memory to remember the sum and difference formulas from trig. This difference, okay, this is even, right? If I interchange theta 1 and theta 2, I get the same thing. It's a cosine, right? Odd thing, interchanging the two, if I interchange theta 1 and theta 2, that's the same, yeah, why is that the same? Did I do it right? Let's see. Well, it'll work out right, but let's see. So, what is it? How do we know what this is? it's got to be a the cos, cos, and sine, sine ones are cosine. The sine, cos, and cosine ones are sines. Okay, so we're going to get a cosine of something here. We're going to get a sine of something there. And this is a sine of something. This is a cosine of something. Okay, that much you can just see by whether you have cos, cos, or sine, cos. Okay, here's a sure way to tell. If you change the sine of theta 1 and theta 2. Okay, you're always talking about sine of theta 1 plus or minus theta 2 and cosine of theta 1 plus or minus theta 2. If you change the signs of both of these, cosine is even, so it doesn't change. Well, that's true here. Both of these change signs, so this is even if I change the sign of both thetas. This is odd if I change the sign of both thetas, because each of the signs changes signs. So this has to be a sine. Right. That has to be a cosine. That's the way to see that. Now, to see whether it's plus or minus here, change one of these to plus or minus the other. So if I let theta 2 equal theta 1, I get cos squared minus sine squared. That's a double angle formula. All right. If I let cos theta 2 equal minus theta 1, then this is still cos squared theta 1, but this becomes, this one becomes minus sine theta 1, so it changes it to a plus and I get 1. So if this is minus theta 1 here, then the whole expression is 1. Well, that means that, all right, if I set theta 2 to minus theta 1, I get cosine of 0, so it's got to be plus. So this has to be theta 1 plus theta 2. Right? Everybody see it? Because if theta 2 is minus theta 1, I get 1. Okay, this is the same thing down here, theta 1 plus theta 2. Clearly this is minus that one, so I get a minus whatever this is. And so this, is it plus or minus? Well, once again, if theta 2 is minus theta 1, this gives me 0. So it's the sum. Like that. And that is another group element, g of theta 1 plus theta 2. So I've just shown closure of this set of matrices under matrix multiplication. Matrix multiplication is associative. Let's finish proving it's a group. Okay, so it's closed. The identity, it has to be of this form, but if I set theta equals 0, I get cosine 0 is 1, sine 0, minus sine 0 is 0, sine 0 is 0, cosine is 1. Clearly that's going to act as the multiplicative identity because it's the identity matrix. So there's just an identity. Inverses. G of theta inverse is just, I claim, G of minus theta. That follows immediately from this law here. All right. What does theta 2 have to be so that I get G of 0 here? Minus theta 1. So G of minus theta is the inverse to G of theta. So we have inverses, and finally, matrices are associative. Proof. Mij, Mkl, different matrices here. Product of M times N times, right, that's the IL component of the product times PLS. All right, this is just multiplication of real numbers term by term. So this is the same as MIJ, NJ, L, T, L, S. Right, I'm assuming sums on J and sums on L, so I have a sum of products of real numbers. Addition and multiplication are associative, so it doesn't matter. I don't have to put any parentheses to know what this is. It's just a product of real numbers. So then I can regroup it, J, L, P, L, S, and this is M times N times P, the I, S component, whereas this is M times N times P, the I, S component. And so we've shown that matrix multiplication is associative.
Would it be better to write it with arrays of ordered integers, you know, for each?
If it depends on what space we're in. If we're in a Cartesian, you know, Euclidean space, I can put them down. But yes, if we want to multiply matrices, we should make them one up, one down. Mij, Mjk, a proper sum. So if we have a non-trivial metric, a non-Euclidean metric, yes, you need the index position to be different. We've proved these form on groups. And the, let's ask if they form a manifold. I want to keep the definition up here, so I'll work over here.
The class of, is just under multiplication?
Under group multiplication, and yes, the group multiplication here is defined as matrix multiplication. So yes, closure under multiplication, they have to come back to this same form.
Only on the multiplication.
Yeah. Yeah, a group only has one kind of operation. And in this case, it's matrix multiplication. Okay, so we're good here. Now, do these form a manifold? So I've got G, theta, set of all of these, where zeros less than equals theta less than 2 pi. Let me, that counts everything once. So so here's our group. Does that form a manifold? Well, it maps very nicely to the circle. Circle. That's one. Yes, it's a manifold. You know, what are our charts? Well, you can choose any couple of charts. So, you want to choose, one there and, another better overlap. So let's choose everything around there. And those two charts will nicely cover the manifold S1. And we need to come up, measure theta from someplace. And so the mapping is theta goes to theta or theta goes to theta plus pi, something like that. So they're nice maps. One I'm going to do this rather quickly because these guys did a lot of manifold stuff last term, and I don't want to belabor that. The real thing that we need is that the group elements can be labeled by some real parameters. In this case, just one. It's called a one-dimensional group because there's just one parameter. Simplest group, complete group we can write. The other thing I want to check is the group product is continuous. So let's use our formula here. So let's see, I don't need to keep all of them back. This ends up equaling g of theta 1 plus theta 2. So, you know, what does continuous mean? If I change, say, let's see, theta 1 or theta 2, let's look at theta 2 plus epsilon. So, if g of theta 2 plus epsilon minus g of theta 2 is very small, that needs to imply that g of theta 1, g of theta 2 plus epsilon minus g of theta 1, g of theta 2 is small. We could do an epsilon delta argument here. I don't know if you guys like those. What's that?
Yeah, I don't. This doesn't seem quite obvious yet, but it will, I'm sure.
Do you want to do a formal argument here? Okay. So, continuous. A function f of x is continuous.
Oh, wait. Okay.
At,
there we go.
X naught. If, let's see, what do we need? We need the limit of, let's see, oh boy, let's see, it's been a while. What is it?
The epsilon goes to zero.
Is it epsilon goes to zero?
Yeah.
I mean, well, f of x, let's say, minus epsilon is f of x, or x naught minus epsilon is f of x naught. Okay, so the value of the limit as we approach x naught is, in fact, x naught. So the picture you should have is we've got some function f of x. Here's x, here's x naught. And so the function goes along, you know, doing its thing. And the question is, at this point, is the value of the function equal to the limit of values as we approach, in this case, from below? You can ask about being continuous above and continuous below. For a continuous function, it's continuous at every point from both directions. Okay, so now we remember what continuous means, except that what does the limit mean? The limit, if epsilon goes to zero of f of x naught minus epsilon equals f of x naught means, for all epsilon greater than zero, there exists a delta greater than zero such that f of x naught plus epsilon minus f of x naught is less than delta magnitude whenever, oh, it's been a long time, whenever
f of x minus x naught
is less than epsilon. So, I've said this backwards though. So, for any delta greater than zero, there exists an epsilon greater than zero such that, I can guarantee this by choosing x close enough to x naught. That's what taking a limit means.
Have you guys done problems like this? Have you worked through this sort of thing? Have you forgotten it?
I did it last semester. Joe's probably never done this.
Calculus, you're supposed to do this sort of thing.
Well, actually, they moved it back. You don't do it until foundation.
When do you do that?
That's not even required for physics.
I had this my first semester, or my first quarter on in college.
Yeah, they sort of go over it, but they don't really do anything about it.
Why did you take the one instead of any delta?
Well, I was being sloppy. I'll do it carefully. I'll reword this. Let me redo this. So this is the definition of a function being continuous at a point.
I think that's actually smooth. Maybe not smooth because you can remove the point and it's still whole. Yeah, you can remove the point so it's not quite continuous.
I've got the point right there.
There we go. Yeah, you're right. Okay.
Right. Now, this is the definition of limit, then, and then there are derivatives and things. But,
okay. Right. Okay. For some reason, I was thinking that there was a, like...
Okay, so... Now I need to be careful about what I mean by this, because this is a difference of matrices. So what I really want is, you know, for this to hold for each component of the matrix. So
we need to make epsilon a matrix of infinitesimally.
Yeah. So what we want is let's see, for this product to be continuous. It ought to be true on either factor. I'll just do it on the second factor. You could also, you know, wiggle, say, the 1, but let's just wiggle 1 at a time, and you can, you know, like, you can take a limit from both directions and demand they agree. A continuous function is one where, no matter which way you take the limit, at which point, you know, this holds at all x0. This definition is independent of whether x is above or below x naught. That actually includes both directions. So what we want is g of theta. Let's take g of theta g of phi. And we know that g of theta plus phi because we've just worked that out. But what does it mean for that to be continuous? Well, we need the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of g of theta g of phi plus epsilon to be equal to g of theta plus phi. That's what we want. And that means that the limit now as epsilon goes to 0
the product
matrix, right? What's that? Maybe equals to the product of the matrix. You could just put a G between, or G of theta, G of phi, G of epsilon.
You can just put G of epsilon.
Yeah,
plus epsilon.
Yeah. Oh, so that's nice. Right. Okay.
Throw that in there, and then it's pretty straightforward. That's one of the
two. Probably so. Yeah, so that equals the limit as epsilon goes to 0 of G of theta times G of phi times G of epsilon.
As epsilon goes to 0, G of theta.
So that's G of theta plus phi limit of G of... Oh, this is too easy. Okay. And G of epsilon is just cosine epsilon minus sine epsilon sine epsilon cos epsilon. And so the limit is the identity.
Right.
So it's continuous. Yeah. And it's a pretty trivial case, but, you know, all the cases we're going to deal with are trivial, and we're not going to really need to check this much. But, you know, we could go through an epsilon delta argument with that, too. The one thing that this leaves a little nebulous is the idea of some sort of uniform convergence, because... all right, here we only have a one-parameter group, but, you know, if we had some matrices that depended on n parameters, you know, it's got to be continuous in each one. So what you do is you just look for continuity in one at a time. But it's trivial here because each component of G is a continuous function. Sine and cosine are continuous functions of their argument. And so continuity is something that we, you know,
take for granted almost.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, we've known this since we, you know, first played with sine and cosine. You know, these are continuous functions. So
whether they're complex or otherwise?
Well, actually, that's an interesting thing with complex functions. Because, you know, if you take a limit as epsilon goes to zero, epsilon is complex, and now you have to approach from every direction in the complex plane. And this is how you get the Cauchy-Riemann equation for analytic functions of the complex plane. You want to take the derivative as the limit, right? And you can take that limit as epsilon goes into your point from any direction. Well, there are two independent directions, so you get two conditions that have to give the same result. It's the Cauchy-Riemann equation. Go from the complex numbers to the quaternions, and you have too many conditions to actually satisfy. You don't get any interesting differentiability.
You get there with complex, but not with...
Yeah, with quaternions and octonions, it's, you know, it's too many constraints to give you very many differentiable functions. You know, maybe linear functions or something are differentiable in the true sense of, you know, all those limits holding.
So in the complex case, epsilon is complex.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, you want to do everything.
You've got two limits.
Yeah.
As A and B, let's say.
Yeah, X plus I, Y. So X goes to X
mod,
or Y goes to
and delta or some two, and make them one complex.
Yeah, epsilon plus I delta, let epsilon and delta go independently to zero. So you have really two cases to consider actually suffice. Okay.
There are some funny things that you see in calculus where, as opposed to approaching on an axis, approaching zero on axis, you approach via function, let's say. And you, there are a few places where you can find that the limit appears to exist as you approach it these ways, but it doesn't along a curve.
Yeah, yeah.
So are there... Are we actually exhausting all of our cases of, proving that the limit exists? Or?
With Lie groups, these are real manifolds. So these are real. These are functions of real variables. Yeah. So let's see.
Is there another way to get to zero that?
Yeah, you know, we're only asking for continuity, so yeah, we should check every direction of approach, but. Since we're always going to be writing, you know, very simple functions like this to represent our group, it's not really going to be a problem. It'll be obvious that the functions we're dealing with are continuous. So, you can come up with functions, you know, that have sort of, let's try and draw a nasty function here. You've got some function that, you know, is taking on, you know, nice smooth values here, and then you've got, you know, like a rift somewhere, and it jumps distance continuously. Well, you know, you're going to see that kind of a jump, you know, even going along the coordinate direction. What would you have to do to not see it from those?
You'd have to have it be symmetric all except for one little point where it went up.
Yeah.
I'd have to have a discontinuity in one point. Of a direction.
Yeah, but one point, you know, I mean, by continuity, we mean continuity at every point. So, you know, if I've got a function that, you know, so here's x and y, and, you know, here's my function, except that, you know, there's no sensible value there. you know, or it takes a value here that's different, that's not continuous. Right? And even if I do it in a plane, any direction I approach that point from, I'm going to see that discontinuity.
We're never going to need to make some discontinuity a Rankine kind of...
Well, okay, here's a case where you do have to pay attention to direction. Here's an example. So suppose we have a function that's semi-continuous. This is the kind of thing you're thinking of, maybe. So, you know, here's x, here's my function of x. And I've got a function that goes along and has its endpoint there, but, you know, it's open where it picks up here. So it's continuous from the left side, but it's not continuous from the right. So taking a limit coming in here, that point is missing. Whereas taking a limit coming in up here, the point is fine. It's part of the function. So, you know, f at x naught is that value up there, so it's left continuous, not right continuous. You could have something like that. Yeah.
They also have pictures where what it is there's a point where it's continuous in every direction, but like say 10 degrees, and those 10 degrees have a curve to them that goes up at that point exactly. So at the point, it raises infinitesimally above it, so that it's not the same.
From certain directions.
Direction.
Yeah, so
as you rotate
so
around,
if we look down on the
continuous,
plane.
Continuous, and all of a sudden not continuous, 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 continuous.
Yeah, so it's, you know, we've got some sort of a wedge here, that kind of thing, where so any approach here, you run into this kind of problem.
Right.
You don't have the limit, but you've got all these limit points here as you approach from any of these directions. So these directions
right.
are all okay, but if you come at it from that side, you see the
exactly. And that way you can go along your x and your y
yeah.
direction and never
yeah.
see your problem.
Which is just, it's a generalization of this. So, you know, if I'm going this direction, I've got continuity this direction, but not that direction.
Yeah.
So, and of course there are much worse functions in the world than those. There are things that are non-continuous at every point.
But is this going to destroy our group?
It's sure going to mess up your manifold.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's got to be a manifold and it's got to be continuous. And, you know, we tend to recognize continuous functions when we see them. We're not going to be using any really bizarre functions. So we're not going to run into these problems. It's fun stuff. I mean,
there are a lot of
functional analysis is cool. But
it would be undefined at a certain point and we patch them. Do we see this in physics, or do we only talk about this in math?
Well, let's see. Fractals. I mean, there are functions that are, there are continuous at every point and non-differentiable at every point. I mean, there are some wild functions you come up with, but in physics, the worst sorts of things you see usually are fractals, which are, which can be totally non-differentiable everywhere. They come up.
I don't know what I've seen the pictures.
The Koch curve is the limit of this sequence of, putting a triangle, you just divide it into thirds and then keep doing the same thing iteratively. So each segment is divided into thirds and you erect a little equilateral triangle on that segment. And you do this ad infinitum.
Oh, is it?
And, you know, so you've got some very complicated zigzag thing of dimension log 4 over log 3, bigger than 1 and less than 2. And in fact, you know, if you make this angle a little sharper, you can produce a curve of any Hausdorff dimension between 0 and 1. Between 1 and 2.
Hausdorff
dimension is a way of defining the dimension of a set by covering it with... So what you want to do is cover this with a bunch of open disks, and you estimate the size of each disk, and multiply by the number of disks and take a limit, and the dimension is defined as the power of the size of each disk that makes the limit finite. So, you know, here you can do it pretty easily, because you can cover this to a good approximation by, well, here you have four pieces, one piece, here you've got eight pieces become four, so you have 16 pieces. So, in general, you have 4 to the n pieces, and each one is of length 1/3 to the n. Well, the limit of that as n goes to infinity is infinite, so the length of that curve in the usual sense of the plane is infinite. But if you say, well, I'm going to define the area or the dimension of this subset of the plane to be that value of d that makes this measure finite in the infinite limit, so you want this to be bounded away from 0 and infinity, what you find is that d has to be log 4 over log 3, which, of course, is between 1 and 2. So, you know, this is a simplified version of the Hausdorff dimension where the figure is self-similar. Okay, so you can sort of cheat and just look at the size of the line instead of picking an open set that contains the line and taking its diameter, but you can see how you could generalize this. None of this moves us along with Lie group theory.
Thank you for showing
me. This is fun stuff, and you know, it could very well have some. Well, fractals have had useful applications to physics.
Where?
And well, you can model some things that are. Let's see. You know, the occurrence of certain diseases is fractal. What is it? There's a fractal dimension associated with river systems or with distribution of rocks on a slope. You know, you have a few big rocks and a larger number of somewhat smaller rocks and an even larger number of even smaller rocks. It turns out to be approximately fractal. Branching of trees. There are lots of biological systems that do it. Some physical systems you can construct, for example, one of the experiments that's been done to test fractals in nature involve cells, a thermal cell containing a fluid. And if you hold the top at a temperature T and the bottom at a temperature T plus delta T, now, mind you, you have to hold the temperature to something like a micro degrees, so it takes an apparatus the size of, like, you know, that corner of the room to do this precisely. But what happens is, you start to get little convection rolls. You know, they're cylindrical rolls like this in the fluid. So the fluid likes to rise, right? The fluid wants to come up like that, and so these cylinders form that let it do that. So you get another one here, so you get fluid rising here. Because of the slight heat differential, it's trying to equilibrate. Well, what happens is, as you vary this temperature difference, you need a tunable parameter in these systems. These cylinders start to get an oscillation down the length of the cylinder, and it shows period doubling. Right? As you increase that temperature difference, let's see what happens. So you've got some frequency of oscillation along these convection rolls. And so let's plot the frequency of that versus your adjustable parameter here. And, you know, you just get some onset at some finite difference. You know, at low enough temperature difference, they're just nice cylinders. But then you hit a critical temperature, and it bifurcates. So you actually get two different
frequencies superimposed. So after a certain point,
you get two frequencies that separate.
After another, sooner, you get each of these things splitting. This turns out to be a fractal curve. It keeps period doubling with a finite limit. So theoretically in models, you can see that there's a certain temperature where chaos is achieved. Chaos is, a countably infinite number of frequencies at a certain limiting temperature.
Oh, you need to get to infinity before it's chaotic?
Yeah.
Do you need to get to infinity?
Yeah. Yeah, otherwise you're still in the period doubling regime. I mean, you can produce these states. You, experimenters at Chicago have seen about 5 period doublings in this system. This beautiful work by Leap Chabet. You can mathematically model these, run them on computers and things, and you continue getting more and more frequent period doublings until you hit the chaotic point. So the approach to chaos is very, there's this rigorous approach where you have a discrete number of frequencies happening. You know, it's an amazing thing that, you can actually make these predictions in here. You're looking at an extremely complicated system, and yet there's a finite number of frequencies that characterize what's going on there. Yes, there are physical systems that display this kind of complexity. This thing is a fractal. I don't know its dimension, but it's self-similar. If you magnify a piece like this and blow it up, it matches on the whole picture. Right? Self-similarity is the simplest way to produce a fractal.
Okay. Are all fractals going to be self-similar?
No, not necessarily.
Because you see these pictures that are just wildly complex, and then you zoom in. And
the Mandelbrot set. The Mandelbrot set is it's different everywhere. Yeah, that's a very complicated set and a very simple equation to describe it. But it's something like Zn plus 1 is, what is it, Z squared plus B? I think you square it and add a certain complex number. And the Mandelbrot set is the set of all complex numbers C for which this converges. This is the end. So you step this infinitely, and if after an infinite number of steps, this is still finite, that point is in the Mandelbrot set. If this eventually diverges off to infinity, the point is not in the Mandelbrot set. These beautifully colored things you see, they're actually going up to some finite number n, and they're coloring differently things that diverge after a different number of steps. It's the black points in the middle that are in the set.
Only that set.
Yeah, the beautiful colored things aren't in the set. how long it took. That the colors are a measure of how long it took to discover it wasn't in the set. So, you can just zoom in and zoom in and zoom in forever, and the boundary of the Mandelbrot set is a continuous and non-differentiable function, non-differentiable everywhere. It's a very, very complicated thing from this very, very simple formula.
See, computers are useful.
Yeah.
Yep.
Computers are fun. Yeah.
I was starting by saying that I think often quantum mechanics, like those paths that particles take, are non differential because of the, the uncertainty principle.
That's something that is. You're pretty much counting all functions in a path integral, right? The way you construct it. Right, you're going from here to here, but what you end up doing is integrating over all at every point in between. Well, that's every function. So it could be here, then here, then here, then there's nothing continuous about the paths that you're considering when you compute it that way. Now, whether it's actually necessary to compute
that or whether a continuous approximation is sufficient or even required. You know, I don't know how you'd even tell whether, you know, the problem is there is no actual path.
Right.
So, you know, it's just a sort of a mnemonic to think of, oh, we're averaging every possible path a thing can take. Well, you know, there's probably some whole complete different way of understanding what's going on here that, you know, you never even think about a path. You know, it's some, you know, it's worse with field theory where you sum over every field configuration. The path integral or other approximation methods in quantum mechanics or quantum field theory are things that give you pictures that let you think about, you know, what calculation you want to do and how you want to do it, and it gives you a nice perturbation theory, but in terms of telling you anything about what's actually going on, the whole point is you don't know what's actually going on. You make a measurement here, you make a measurement there, and that's what you know about the system. And anything else you might claim to know could be false. So you average over every possible thing that could have happened between here and there, and that's your best way of, you know, predicting the probability of it, you know, coming out, you know, here or there, by averaging over every possible thing. Well, not all those paths are equally weighted. You know, you do have a potential, say, in quantum mechanics, or, you know, there are potentials in field theory too. Those are usually continuous functions that smoothly vary the probability for the field to do, you know, whatever it is it's doing it's here and then it's there.
For conservative forces only? Or is this for any...
Yeah, the thing that I think most field theorists have decided is that if your theory does not come from an action, it's probably not a good theory. Because, for one thing, you don't know how to quantize it. So if you take the path integral quantization as your... All right, this is how we quantize things. We write a path integral or a sum over histories of e to the I over h bar times the action. You need to have a classical action. Or, you know, you can't use that rule for quantizing the theory. So it's generally assumed that a fundamental theory is one that arises from some action. Action functional. Could be wrong, of course, but actually it suffices. I mean, you know, the standard model and general relativity all arise from actions. And so there's no real reason to push yourself to consider others, except for general interest, and, you know, like, what is it? We wrote down a theory one time where you not only varied the field, but you varied the dimension of the action integral. And, you know, there were actually preferred dimensions that turned out, we just did a little scalar field, you know, but you could add terms and, you know, you can consider a whole lot of different things.
Pretty close to anything.
Yeah, it was very near to each integer we found a solution.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, regroups. I remember. Let's have a look. We really want them to be differentiable. You know, continuous is probably enough to prove that these things are what we think they are. But let's see. You know, we want to do sort of a Taylor series in these group elements. That's how we analyze them. Let's think of some other examples of Lie groups, and then look at how we actually analyze some Lie group. We'll take the simple one first. But examples. The name of that group is the SO2. The special orthogonal group in two dimensions. Special, the determinant of theta is 1. Well, check. You know, we've got cosine theta minus sine theta. This is going to work. Sine theta, cos theta. And the determinant of that is 1. Cos squared plus sine squared. So that's 1. So S stands for special. O stands for orthogonal. And this comes from the fact that it turns out that the best way to specify a group, a Lie group, is by what it leaves invariant. The orthogonal group leaves the Euclidean metric unchanged. What that means is, you know, x dot x, essentially. You know, we can write that as delta AB XA XB for a Euclidean metric, metric doubly covariant. So we want some transformation O with, say, matrix components AB that we apply to x to get some new x tilde. Okay, that's a general linear transformation for an arbitrary non-degenerate matrix O. This gives us a perfectly good mapping from n-dimensional vectors to n-dimensional vectors. If we, in addition, suppose that we preserve this length, then it has to be the case that O A B X B Kronecker A C, then O C D X D has to be the same as Kronecker A B X A X B. That's what it means for X tilde to have the same length, X tilde A, X tilde C, to have the same length as X. Right, this is what we think of as a rotation or an orthogonal transformation. Now,
what's the normal?
Orthogonal. Nothing normalized here. This works for any x. But now if we have, write this as delta AC O AB O CD. Separate those, and then we have XB XD. That has to be the same as delta BD XB XD for all x.
Doesn't your operator have to be normalized, though? Otherwise, you'll get a length problem.
I'm deriving the property O has to have here.
Oh, okay.
And so that comes out of this analysis. What we need here. Okay, notice that XBXD is a symmetric object. So that means that the symmetric part of this, so since this is symmetric, if this had an anti-symmetric part, you would get zero regardless. All it tells you about is the symmetric part of this on BD. So this, for all x, is equivalent to delta AC O A B O C D plus delta A C O A E O C D has to be equal to delta B D plus delta D B. Symmetric part on both sides. I'm not dividing by a half to normalize it. Cancel the one half. Okay, everybody see that follows?
Okay.
I'm just symmetrizing on BD.
Okay.
So this being true for all X means that matrix and that matrix have to be the same, have to have the same symmetric part. This could have some anti-symmetric part that would just go away and be zero anyway. So it only allows you to compare the symmetric parts. Now these happen to both be symmetric, so it won't matter. This is just twice delta BD because the identity matrix is symmetric. I can write this as delta CA OCB OAD because delta is symmetric, and then I can rename A and C, so I just get two of these. So I cancel the two, and I get delta AC. Let me write it this way: OCD OAB equals delta BD. Now, this is normal matrix multiplication, adjacent indices summed. This is not, because the A is over here. I want inside indices summed. I can write this as O transpose the BA component times delta AC times O CD component equals delta AC, or even better, O transpose BA identity matrix AC orthogonal transformation CD component equals identity matrix the AC component. And now it's clear that this is normal matrix multiplication, so I just need O transpose times the identity times O equals the identity, or discarding the identity, O transpose O equals 1, which is equivalent to O transpose equals O inverse, the usual condition for orthogonality. These form a group. And notice I haven't specified the range of the indices, you know, A, B, but indeed they can run up to any N. This includes the 2x2 case, but it gives us a group in any dimension. So if O is N by N, we get a group, and we call the group O-N. Duh. Why wouldn't we? It's the orthogonal group in N dimension. Now, notice that the determinant of O transpose O equals the determinant of the identity, which is 1. The determinant of the transpose of the matrix is the same as the determinant of the matrix. So this is just the determinant of O squared has to be 1, so the determinant of an orthogonal matrix has to be plus or minus 1. And it turns out that those parts of the group are disconnected, right? There is no orthogonal transformation that takes us continuously from determinant minus 1 to plus 1, because somewhere along the way you'd have to have determinant 0, and that wouldn't be invertible, so that can't be a group element. Let's see, where do we want to go with this? The determinant of O equals plus 1, if we restrict to determinant plus 1, then we get the special orthogonal group in N dimension.
That's when you are in the real plane, right?
Real N-dimensional.
Real, yes,
that's right. If we're doing rotations in complex space, of course, there's a corresponding set of unitary groups, and these are also Lie groups. Well, how many, what's the dimension?
The dimension.
How many independent rotations do we expect in n dimensions? Any other suggestions?
3n. 2n.
3n, 2. 1n, 2n, 3n. What did you say, 1? Now you're getting it. How many different ways can you rotate? All right, think differential forms. Think of the curl. How many different components are there to the? How many different planes can we find curls in? Remember, rotations in higher dimensions are not rotations about an axis. You know, there's no axis in four dimensions for a rotation. A rotation of the xy plane. Well, both the z and t directions are orthogonal to the xy plane. They're two independent. Their planes are orthogonal to the plane of rotation.
N times n minus 1.
There you go. N minus 1 over 2. Over 2, right? It's the number of planes in n dimensions. The number of ways of choosing 2 out of n things.
N choose 2.
So you have an independent rotation for every independent plane of an n-dimensional space. So the dimension of these groups gets, they're big. It's going up like n squared. Let's see. Well, those are the orthogonal groups. What groups should we talk about next? I could have started with the general linear groups. The general linear groups that I mentioned here, this is a linear transformation. Oh, we didn't prove it's a group. Since the transpose is the inverse, and we can take the transpose of any, they're all invertible. The identity obviously satisfies this. So 1 is an element of O(n), and O inverse is an element of O(n). So this is good, and we've written them as matrices. So they're matrices. And that implies associative. So that holds. Is it closed? Let's check.
So if I take O1 times O2, the transpose of that times O1, O2 had better be 1 or else it's not closed. Right? The product O1, O2 has to be an orthogonal transformation. The test for an orthogonal transformation is O transpose O equals 1. Well, what's the transpose of a product?
O2 transpose O1.
Yeah, it reverses the order, so you get O2 transpose O1 transpose times O1 O2. Now that's the identity, and so then we get O2 transpose O2, which is the identity, so it's closed.
And therefore, the orthogonal transformation form. Alright, now we have an infinite number of Lie groups. Right? We've got an ON for every integer. We've got an SON for every integer. Let's get some more groups.
Are the groups countably infinite or uncountably infinite?
Countably.
Okay.
There are 3 countably infinite classes, and then 5 exceptional cases where you just have a certain group of one dimension, just 5 more groups. So 3 infinite classes and 5 groups. You've got general linear, you've got orthogonal, you've got special orthogonal, you've got unitary, special unitary. So, what we're counting here are simple groups. And the orthogonal groups are not simple. all right, you know, this thing isn't connected. This is actually, you know, O-N can be written as S-O-N, a direct product with the Boolean group, you know, plus or minus one. So O-N is basically two copies of S-O-N, one with determinant plus one, one with determinant minus one. Now, the other copy doesn't really have an identity in it, just the identity has determinant plus one. So only the piece with determinant plus one is a subgroup. But you're really just looking at a direct product here. So the special groups are the simple ones, but the orthogonal group is doesn't count as a simple group. Let's look at general linear.
On this notion you just presented, with the z is z integer.
Yeah, that's just and plus or minus one under what? Multiplication. Right? So think of ordered pairs where we've got an element of SON and a plus or minus one, and use our Cartesian product on those, and that'll be a. Let's see, is that right? It just gives us two copies of this continuous
with only one identity.
With only one identity, yeah.
But the two subscript means
these
what?
Two there are two elements in this group.
Oh, okay.
Just plus or minus one is the two elements.
Okay.
So it's a discrete group, it's not a Lie group. Now O-N is a Lie group, but S-O-N is a simple Lie group. Let's look at the general linear group. This is actually familiar. It's just, you know, take any linear combination of the components of a vector in n dimensions, and you require this to be a group. Well, requiring it to be a group means, all right, well, we have an identity. That's okay, that's an n by n matrix. But not all n by n matrices are in this group, only the invertible ones. So G, L, N is the set of invertible n by n matrices. And, you know, that's clearly closed because the product of two invertible matrices is invertible. By definition, we've got inverses. We know the identity is in there and invertible. Matrix multiplication is associative. So these form a group, and these are really the basis for, you know, the orthogonal group, because now you put a restriction on this. Let's see, the general linear group. How many degrees of freedom here? What's the dimension of this?
General.
Yeah.
Ten squared.
Yeah. Yeah. You've got them all. There are a few isolated points missing, but the determinant, the n by n matrices with vanishing determinant form a set of measure zero in the space of all matrices, so it's still dimension n squared. Then, of course, we've got SLN.
Why wouldn't it be n squared minus n?
It doesn't have to be
N squared minus n.
You said there were points that. You can have that.
Points.
That were not within. N
yeah, the thing is, okay, so if I've got, you know, F, G, H, K, I've got four, you know, we've got some matrix. Okay, what numbers can go here? Well, any numbers such as FK minus HG is not equal to zero. That's almost all numbers. So there's one isolated point. So, you know, we have N squared here is four. So we have all but a countable number of points in R4. That's still a set of dimension 4. Okay, so it's, you know, we're only excluding a very few isolated
points. Oh, I see. I thought it was a whole set of them.
Yeah. Now, there's no continuum of things missing here. Jay?
Another way of looking at it is it has to be dependent for that to happen. One row has to depend on the other one, and that only happens if you have the same thing repeated.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
If you take out the repetition, you don't have that
problem. Right, yeah. You're only eliminating, you know, a small subset. SLN, what is that? That's the set of all GLN with that G equals 1. So if you choose to get a determinant one. And that's a simple group, whereas, you know, this is, GLN is not, because, you know, there's an overall real factor times our matrix MAB, and this factor commutes with the matrix. You know, essentially, you know, SLN times one real number, you know, basically the real here is what gives you GLN. So GLN is really composite because that there's an overall multiple that just commutes with everything. In general, matrices don't commute, right? We know that from quantum mechanics. Matrices A times B is not equal to B times A. So in general, these things are not abelian proof. With the exception of SO2, which we saw, you know, amounts to addition, but rotation in a plane and another rotation in the same plane, there's only one plane, so that turns out to be a commutative group.
So abelian simply means it doesn't commute?
Abelian means it does commute.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. Let's see. Then, okay, the orthogonal transformations preserve a symmetric form, usually the identity. They preserve some metric, some symmetric thing. We have another class that preserve an anti-symmetric thing. So you can ask for transformations, a subgroup of the general linear group that preserves some anti-symmetric matrix. Alright, well, to be anti-symmetric, yeah, it turns out you can always put it in the form of an identity here and minus an identity there. And that form makes it, suggests to us that this only exists in even dimensions. Well, that's true. It does only exist in even dimensions. This object is required to satisfy some properties. It's got to be non-degenerate. An anti-symmetric matrix in odd dimensions is degenerate. So anyway, you can prove that these groups exist for all even numbers. They're called the symplectic groups in dimension 2. So for any n, we have such a group on that acts on 2n-dimensional vectors. Let's see. Then we have complex generalizations of these things. So we have, say, the special linear group in n complex dimensions. A very important subcase of this is SL2C. Does anybody know what SL2C is? I mean, you can tell me the obvious thing. Tell me the obvious thing first. What is it?
SL2C?
Yeah. What do I mean by SL2C?
Two-dimensional.
Okay. Two-dimensional.
complex.
Yeah.
Linear.
And, yeah, linear, there, yeah, linear. So, matrices. Matrices are linear, so matrices.
It was
determinant. Yeah.
So that would be Hermitian, wouldn't
it? Or no, not Hermitian. General linear, you know, we're not, there's no symmetry imposed here. There's just, there's one constraint. It's a complex constraint, so it's two. So how many dimensions is SL2C? How many real dimensions for SL2C?
Is it four?
How many?
Is it four?
Well, real dimensions, I think it's two.
Think it through.
If you want.
So here we have beta, mu, nu, four complex numbers.
Yes.
We have det g equals one is alpha, nu, minus, beta, mu. How many conditions is that?
Oh.
But there's two constraints, yeah. So the imaginary part vanishes, the real part is one.
Yes.
So that's two constraints. On how many numbers?
Four.
No. How many real numbers?
Two.
How many real numbers here?
Four.
Four complex numbers. How many real?
Eight.
Eight.
Eight. Yeah. Three real, one for each complex.
Okay, two constraints, so we have six real dimensions. So SL2T is it's not a trivial group. Anybody know what group it is? It's a familiar group.
Lorentz?
Very good, that's what I
It's the Lorentz group. It's the covering group of the Lorentz group. Let's check. Let me see. How can we show this in the easiest way? Oh, we need some technique. May want to wait on this.
I'm just curious. I can see it's Lorentz, but I can't tell why. Like. That was my
Question. Yeah, the thing is, the whole wonderful thing about Lie groups is that since they're manifolds, you can look at infinitesimal structures. Since we've got this smoothness or this, you know, continuity, you can look at an infinitesimal neighborhood of the transformations, or say of the identity, and find some much simpler relationships that hold for infinitesimal transformations. And the magic is you can use that information to reconstruct the original group. So by studying what's called the Lie algebra, turns out there's an algebra satisfied by the infinitesimal transformations. By looking at that object, you can understand really all of the local properties of the group, you know, everything but maybe global topology, which you can get at other ways. But you really understand most of what you want to know, especially for physics purposes, about groups by looking at the infinitesimal transformations, which make the whole problem linear. And now we're dealing with vector spaces and just linear combinations of things. It becomes very simple. And we can always get back to the whole group. Well, if we look at the infinitesimal transformations here, it turns out that we can write them as linear combinations of Hermitian and anti-Hermitian. So we can write one linear combination of polymatrices and another linear combination of I times the polymatrices. Those can be the six generators. When you get then back to generating the group, you
you'll reconstruct a general matrix of unit determinants as these polymatrices are traceless. You end up exponentiating this. We're gonna look at this in detail. I'm just sketching what happens.
Are each one of these just gonna look like column back?
No, each of these is a matrix. So what you have to you end up exponentiating. This is an infinitesimal generator for like small a and b. A general group element we're going to find is the exponential of an object like this. And, you know, because you've got real and imaginary combinations of three polymatrices, the exponential of it, since these are traceless, the exponential has unit determinant. That's what happens with Hermitian and linear matrices. But it turns out that, let me see, which is it now? These are rotations and those are boosts. We'll show this explicitly. We'll work through this group and see it. There's another way to get at this. Hang on, let me see. To see that these are Lorentz transformations. Let's do it this way. This is better. Let's look at this. Consider, let's take our spatial coordinates and sum with four matrices where the sigma mu are just the identity and the three polymatrices. So what I mean by this then is T times the identity, and X, Y, and Z times the polys will give X minus YY here and X plus YY there, and then plus Z and minus Z here. So I can write this 2x2 Hermitian matrix. That's a general Hermitian matrix. So if I call that capital X, that's equal to X dagger. How many Hermitian matrices are there in among 2x2 matrices? There are four independent parameters, and they might as well be T, X, Y, and Z. Notice that the determinant of X is something familiar. We get T squared minus Z squared on the diagonal, then we subtract X squared plus Y squared on the anti-diagonal, and that's the negative of the line element. That's kind of cool. So what properties do we need? We need Hermitian, and we want to preserve the determinant of X. So any transformation preserving 1 and 2 takes X mu sigma mu to some new linear combination of the sigma mu's with X mu tilde X mu equals X mu X mu. Preserve tau, preserve the line element. Therefore, is a Lorentz transformation.
So preserving hermeticity means that we can always identify four coordinates. Preserving the determinant means we've preserved the line element, therefore we have a mapping from four vectors to four vectors that preserves the line element, and that's what we mean by a Lorentz transformation. Now, what transformations do it? Let x tilde equal a x a dagger. Then x tilde dagger is equal to a dagger dagger x dagger a dagger. A dagger dagger is just a. X is Hermitian, and a dagger is a dagger, and that is x tilde. So anything of this form for any complex matrix 2x2 A preserves hermeticity. We also need the determinant is this Hermitian. Hermitian, if x is. So we need that x tilde equal, we're going to demand this, that x, and what does that mean? That of a dagger equals that x, and by a familiar argument, that means that det A times its complex conjugate has to be 1. So the determinant of A is e to the I phi for some angle phi, but let's let B equal e to the minus I phi times A, then that B equals, okay, have I done this right? Or do I want 5 or 2? That A, probably want 5 or 2 here, right? Because it comes in squared. So that B is e to the minus 5 phi over 2 squared times that A is 1.
Oh, that's true.
And what we see is B times X times B dagger is equal to e to the minus I phi over 2 times A times X times B dagger is e to the I phi over 2 A dagger equals A X A dagger equals X tilde, which means that that phase doesn't do anything. The phase is just an overall factor that commutes with everything else and drops out. So the phase does not produce a Lorentz transformation. It just gives us multiple identities. So we take the quotient and demand, so let me say, e to the I phi has no effect, implies distinct Lorentz transformations lie in SL2C. Notice here, A is an element of L2C. Right? It's an arbitrary 2x2 complex matrix, invertible to, we wanted a group element, but we can restrict the determinant to be 1 without losing any Lorentz transformations, and so this proves that the Lorentz transformations are SL2C, are given by SL2C.
by a similarity transformation. And here's an interesting little thing, if you haven't seen it before. When we write Lorentz transformations this way, it is quite natural to ask what states they act on. I mean, they transform these matrices, but that's not the most fundamental state that 2x2 complex matrices act on. Complex 2x2 matrices act on some two-dimensional complex space. What is that space? You got the first letter.
I'm still trying to catch up. I'm a little behind.
All right. Do you have questions before I introduce that? Let me...
I'm just barely catching up to... I'm at SL2C right now. That's where I'm at.
Okay. So, the determiner of A has to be the
space. Right.
So, I can find another matrix B that does the same thing as A,
right,
but has unit determinants. Get B is 1. Right. I've arranged it that way. And it has the same effect on X as A did. So for every Lorentz transformation, all right, this A, A is an element of L2C. Right? It's any 2x2 complex matrix, any invertible 2x2 complex matrix.
And you can choose a B corresponding to that A.
Let's see, I should be calling this GL2C. Sorry. A is an element of GL2C. Then I don't have to say it's invertible, and it is invertible. So for any element of GL2C, I can find an element of SL2C that does the same Lorentz transformation. So that's a simpler way to write the Lorentz group. Everybody up now? We're good? So,
So the answer to your question?
What was the question? I was trying to get to that point. I was just barely hitting that point.
It is dimensional.
So, B acts on two-dimensional complex vectors. So, they're mappings on some two-dimensional vector space. I mean, this sort of precedes even talking about two-dimensional matrices. We have a two-dimensional vector space. We want to look at transformations on it. What are the transformations? GL2C. Right? So now let's back up and say, well, what were those two dimensional vectors? You know what they are?
The two dimensional vectors that they act on?
That the Lorentz group acts on.
Oh,
what two dimensional complex vectors does the Lorentz group act on? This is what a spinner is. This is why there's spin. The reason for spin up and spin down is the two components of this complex factor, spin up and spin down.
The Dirac equation, okay.
Yeah, the Dirac equation is nicely written in terms of SL2C. The Pauli equation, too. Schrodinger equation with spin. You want to deal with some two-dimensional complex vectors, giving you spin up and spin down. So, back when Newton wrote Newton's second law, and it was invariant under SO3, the covering group of SO3 is SU2, a complex two-dimensional group that acts on some two-component spinners. Newton could have invented spin if he'd known enough group theory. Of course, there was no such thing as group theory when Newton was writing F equals ma. But the getting from F equals ma to spinners is just math.
Getting from point A to point B is generally just math.
Yeah, there's a little physics involved, you know. You get this hip action. You know, the hip action when you walk is enough to set off a gravitational wave detector.
Really?
Yeah. You walk within 50 meters of LIGO up here, and it'll look like a wave. It can detect that quadruple moment of your hip. Yeah. You get boogie and you'll set the thing flying.
Yeah,
that's
why there's two things we can compare.
What's that?
That's why there's two things we can compare.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You have to team up and get on your cell phones and dance at the same, you know.
I say we do this at all installments. Can we cover most of them?
Most of what? What's the question?
I was going to say, we should get cell phones and time it, so we can say, hey, look, gravitational waves.
Okay, so for complex matrices, the general, you know, GL2C matrices have a simple subgroup SL2C, SLNC.
Okay.
N by N. Unit determinant complex matrices, invertible. But we can look for subgroups here. If they preserve, what's the complex equivalent of a symmetric matrix?
Hermitian.
The things that do that are unitary. And so we'll get the special unitary groups in N dimensions are they're elements of SLNC that preserve a Hermitian matrix. How about which? Okay, and let's see, there's a complex notion of symplectic groups too, although the nicest way to think of the symplectic groups turns out to be using the quaternion. If you take there's an infinite class of groups that are elements of a projective quaternion space. It's a very slick way to think about these groups. I think Cartan may have looked at them that way, in fact. But those are called FPM, and they're related to the symplectic groups that preserve an anti-symmetric matrix, but you have to complexify and then take a different sort of notion of the real part. So it's a little complicated. But anyway, this is these are most of the groups that we're going to find interesting. The one modification, SLTC turns out to be the Lorentz group. In terms of preserving a metric, right, in space-time, it's not a positive definite metric that's preserved. So instead of the orthogonal groups, we're going to find something like the orthogonal groups, but instead of n dimensions, you have p space-like and q time-like dimensions. So these transformations preserve a matrix with p1s and q-1s. So you can define, you know, modified versions of these groups that actually preserve something with a signature. This doesn't come up with the complex ones because you can always make the minus signs into plus signs with an I. So in the unitary groups, you can always choose the identity to be the metric that's preserved, but for the real ones, you can't. So you get these other cases like this. And these are interesting to us because, for example, the Lorentz group, for example, SO31, is also the Lorentz group. It turns out that SL2C has two transformations for every one in SO31, but they're both perfectly well-defined groups.
There's a smaller group, SL2C still covers it, but there's a smaller group than SL2C then.
Generally you want the biggest one, right? You want the most transformations that...
This doesn't have all the Lorentz transformations in it.
So SL2C has two transformations for every one of those. So those transformations, you get the same set, six-dimensional set of Lorentz transformations, but SL2C knows about spinners.
Got it. Okay.
So you get more information from SL2C. And the, of course, you know, the essentials of spinners have been measured and are necessary to specify a full physical system. So that's really there in nature. So nature knows about SL2C.
Have you seen some of the cool stuff you can do with positive depth in nature too? And non-positive, like with that stuff? There's some really fun math that goes with this. You can,
right. And, well, then by in nature, you can actually represent every degree of polynomial by some positive depth or positive semi-definite nature. And we can use that to find and definite that tells you whether or not you've got a peak or an inflection point.
And that's
the extreme. It'll tell you about the extreme.